Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Quaker Matters podcast. On today's episode, we hear from longtime teacher and the creator of the Global Peace and Justice course, Rick Greer Reynolds. In this episode, Rick discusses his decision to join the Wilmington Friends School community in 1969, why his trip to Cyprus was life-changing in 1973, creating the Global Peace and Justice course in 1979, and his current work with the Alternatives to Violence Project. Hope you enjoy.
I think maybe it's the hope that all of us, every kid in that room, has the power to be a genius, to be extraordinary, to make a difference, no matter where they are.
Hey, Rick, how are you?
I'm well, thank you, Jake. It's nice to be connecting back to Friends School as usual.
Excited to learn more about you, your career, your time at Friends, and really all of the work that you have done throughout your life. So let's start here. I believe back in 1969, can you discuss your free lunch with Ambrose Short and why that moment was so impactful for you and your career?
Well, great. So great question. Good starting point. So 1969, I'm about to graduate from Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. And one of my classmates and good friends there was a Friends School graduate, Hugh Kenworthy. I think his class is 65. And he had mentioned to me that there was this person, who turned out to be Ambrose Short, coming to campus. Mr. Short was on a swing through to look for, teacher recruitment. And I said, sure, I'll go out to lunch with this guy. And I, at that time, actually had been, you're talking about the late 60s, the Vietnam War. And a lot of us were like thinking about, okay, this sort of was a shakeup of a lot of values. And what are you going to do? So I was clearly on a track at that time to go to Wall Street. I mean, that was where I was headed. That's where I grew up in North Jersey. That's what my family did. That's what everybody I knew did that kind of commute to New York and get into that world. So I was very familiar with it. And then I decided, though, that maybe I'd look around, for some other opportunities. And so I actually started taking education courses. I did student teaching. I got myself a Connecticut certificate. And then then my friend Hugh said, hey, would you like to meet this, Ambrose Short? I said, great. So I go out to lunch, and the next thing I know, I'm on an airplane, or I come down to Wilmington for an interview, spent a full day, and I got offered a job literally that night, and took the job, and I showed up, and I always had this sort of tension about, I would say I was a Rockefeller Republican, okay? So I was somewhat conservative. And I didn't know what Quakers were all about. I didn't really, that part of the exploration of this possible job was, it was a private day school. It was a good school. I knew people that went there, all that good stuff. So I take the job, right? And literally my first week on the job come the fall, I parked my car on school road in the front. And in fact, it's quarter seven, whatever, in the morning. And there's this gentleman with a suit and tie on, and he's standing on the curb looking at his house, I thought. And I go, okay, well, guy's probably, morning cup of coffee, he's checking his gutters, whatever he's doing. And I go into the school and, all right, have a day. Come back the next day, park my car, same guy's there, suit, tie, looking at the house. And I go, okay, well, maybe he hasn't quite figured out what's going on or whatever, or picked the color or whatever. And then the third day, I come to park my car, and he's still there. So I go inside, and I say to Agnes Pennock, who's like the school secretary, I go, Agnes, I said, listen, I don't know, it's a little weird. There's some guy standing in the front yard, and he's been there 3 days in a row. I don't really know what to make of it. She goes, oh, Ricky, listen, he's so-and-so, and he's a Quaker, and he's mad at the guy that lives in the other Quaker that lives in the house because the Woodlawn trustees are having a dust-up about selling, real estate on Route 202 for housing developments, right? So she said, he's just conducting a silent vigil. So I go, okay. So that was the first time I had heard silent vigil. And I knew that things are run a little differently down here at that Friends in the school. So my introduction, that was my introduction to Friends School as a daily operating thing. So in that first stint that I did at Friends, I actually stood on a, that first year, I actually defended US involvement in Vietnam as part of a panel. And that's where I was. I mean, that's where my mindset was. Well, that shifted dramatically, over the course of the next year or so as I really got myself, it's like anything. I wasn't really paying attention to it. Trinity College is a pretty conservative place. Wasn't a whole lot of action like there was at Columbia and Berkeley and all those other places. So I started getting touching base not only with Quaker values, but Quakers. And I became more amazed about how they led their lives, their value systems. One of the things that I actually had in my classroom at the end of my career there was a William Penn sort of quote that and said, true godliness doesn't turn one out of the world, colon, but excites one's endeavors to mend it. So I got it very clearly, it became evident to me that this faith, and I was raised Jesuit Catholic, so that's sort of more of a progressive Catholic wing, but this Quakerism had this tenet that one should be active in the world. One should be being prescriptive to deal with whatever it was that was the issue, suffrage, civil rights, climate, pick your topic. So that was my beginnings there. And and I mentioned sort of making that career decision. And part of it was is that I will say that I always had this option to leave teaching and then maybe go back and earn a lot of money. But I never looked back. I never looked back. So if anything, when I would bump into people, and sort of they'd say, hey, what did you do? What did you do? And they're sort of looking over your shoulder or something. I go like, well, it's a bank robber, And they would go like, what? And I go like, well, I had this, I went to this, I had this job and they gave me this money to do that. I was like in the candy store of, so it's a little bit of my weird sense of humor. But anyway, so that was my introduction to Friends School. And it was also, there was a whole bunch of young other faculty that showed up at the same time. Bill Bickley, who's been a longtime friend, John Barbas. There was a whole bunch of us, Carrie Brown, that all showed up around the same time who stuck around, for a long time and became, I think, real contributors to the life of the school. And we're of that same generation of, high-end academic backgrounds, coming to Friends and, falling in love with the place and making a career of it. So, like anything, continuity over time is one of the secret sauces of success in anything. And so when you look at people who have, in fact, graduate, so my year was 2011, was like Terry Maguire and Richard Bernard and myself. And you put all the years together and it was like, 180 years or something crazy, long-term commitment and involvement with the school. So that long answer to the Ambrose short question, but so it was a little bit of serendipity, of that kind of contact.
I guess this is a two-part question here, and I want to learn more about your transition to being what you stated as a Rockefeller, a Republican, to someone that is now Quaker, and also weave in how your trip to Cyprus in 1973 and 74, why that specifically was so life-changing for you.
They have a peace class. In fact, they taught a very, maybe a trimester at the senior level, sort of a peace studies class. And it was an elective. And I became part of that. So that was my first now exposure to what is now peace and conflict studies or the kind of courses that I taught over time. So I was sort of around that course. I was a part of it. And then I got plugged into some Quaker networks, and this is leading to me going overseas to the island of Cyprus and being involved in an amazing, life-changing, pivotal experience where the island of Cyprus had been involved in an unfortunate 10 years of internal, the government collapsed, the ethnicities, which were 80% Greek Cypriot and 20% Turkish Cypriots, the communities totally separated into two different distinct geographical areas, 180 villages or towns where people had lived, totally separated. It was, so people were living as internally displaced persons, at least the Turks were. So there was an opportunity created by a professor at Haverford College who got money from the Lilly Foundation to basically run a an ex not an experiment. It was an experiment of sorts, that so to see if they could replicate what Gandhi did in 1948. So the English leave India, they partition it into West Pakistan, East Pakistan, and they tell basically all the Muslims to move there, like go to California, New Jersey, and then the Hindus can have the rest of the place, right? And they sort of, in 1948, you have the largest migration in the history of the world of people, conflict, riots, all kinds of bad stuff's happening. And Gandhi, who had been sort of the, you know, the architect of sort of getting the British out, now is running around with his followers putting out the fires. And they created a lot of strategies and techniques around there called Shantai Sena, which in Hindi means peace brigade. So what they did was they created all these nonviolent strategies to calm it down, to negotiate it, and then to sort of come up, you know, create, you know, sort of plans moving forward. So that happened in 1948. So a whole bunch of people out of what led by this guy out of Haverford said, hey, can we try that someplace else? Because everybody was saying, well, you know, India's only happened because Gandhi and the British were fair-minded and all that. So they put together a group of which I got invited to be a part of because I had a friend who was friendly with one of the organizers. So about 21 of us from all over the world, the Americans that went were like American civil rights workers, people who had been training under the Kingian banner. There were people from South Africa who had involved in the anti-apartheid movement, were once again, two communities, you know, desperate. There were people from Northern Ireland who had been part of the Catholic Protestant situation there. And then there was all these Indian Indians who were Shantai Sena, who actually would walk into the riots and do all those kinds of things they tried in India. So we all gathered for 3 months on the island of Cyprus to see if we could help resolve the situation of 20,000 internally displaced people. And it was a real education for me. So one of the participants, for example, one of the leader of the Indian contingent was Narayan Desai, and his father was Gandhi's private secretary. So he grew up in Gandhi's ashram. He grew up with Gandhi. All right. So he had all these Gandhi stories, you know, and then, so, I mean, that was just amazing to me to hear, you know, someone that lived with Gandhi, what he was really like and how, you know, he would tell the story about Narayan telling a story about himself in an argument, or excuse me, a conversation that you would, you know, and he's now a teenager. Narayan is a teenager and he's saying to Gandhi, this isn't going to work. This, you know, he's really questioning this nonviolent stuff. The British are never going to do it, you know, and all that. So the ambassadors, you know, the limousine pulls up with all the flags on it, and it's the British High Commissioner or whatever the name of the guy was that ran India. And it's his car to pick up Gandhi to take him to some negotiation, right? And it's, the car's out there for like a long time. And finally, Narayan says to Gandhi, he says, hey, listen, Bapu, Bapu means father. Bapu, listen, the ambassadors, you got the ambassador waiting out in the car. And Gandhi says, how am I going to convince the ambassador if I can't convince you? You know, he can wait. So all those kinds of stories now show up and experiences. And the good news is that it worked. It worked in terms of two sides that wouldn't talk to each other, at least officially, will now officially talk. I won't get all the details, all the work I did on the ground in camps, negotiating. We got both sides to agree to a settlement, put up the money. In fact, this was touted on the floor of the United Nations General Assembly, and it was a big breakthrough, a big break. And it was because people from our backgrounds had credibility, and we had credibility because we weren't politicians, and we had no other agenda than trying to take a bad situation of internally displaced people and all that. And so we lived. It wasn't like we were living in a hotel. We lived in villages. We interacted with the people every day. So I have a million stories. I probably should write a book about it. I started a basketball program, for all these kids, and it was terrific. So that made me a believer. So I myself trained as a political scientist, or still this gone, what is this nonviolent stuff, and how does it really work? And I was a real politicker. I played. I was a recruited athlete out of high school, and I got more scars on my body from my four brothers beating me up. So I was sort of the real politiker guy in the beginning. Now I'm going like, whoa, this works. I've seen it work. I've met people who have been all over the world doing this work. Like anything, once you get out of your little box and go start going to other places and listen to other people tell their stories. So I went back. I go back to friends now, and totally energized that, okay, this is authentic. This is just not somebody writing a book, so I could, and of course I could put stories, real stories on all that. So, and that actually propelled me into Harvard. I mean, that's how I got into Harvard. I mean, it allowed pretty much every door that I knocked on opened up, and I was invited into because of this experience, because people recognized what it was, and it was just phenomenal. So life-changing in many, many, many different ways.
Can you discuss your time at Harvard and what you were able to pick up and take with you from your studies there?
I went and got a master's, and they happened to have a program there called Peace, Justice, and Conflict Studies, I think it was the name of it. And I ended up being a TA in it, like an unofficial TA in it. I wasn't paid. I just became part of the planning team and ran some of the breakout Fridays. And it was an astounding group of, there's like three Nobel Prize winners in this group, and they were the most humble people on the planet. I didn't even know that till later on down the road. Somebody said, "Oh, you worked with Carl Deutsch? He's like the greatest political science of the 20th century." I went like, "I had no idea. He was just a good guy, and he asked me to run a section for him, and so it was just an amazing time there. Just now, it reinforces the academic piece of peace and conflict studies. I started bumping into people, Elise Boulding, who really has to, she's a no longer with us, but she did all the imaging work that I later incorporated into my teaching at Friends School. How to create ordinary people, make them extraordinary. How to create people that have a vision? Because if you're, it's one thing to say stop. I don't like the fact that women don't have equal rights, or whatever you want to say stop to. But you have to have a vision. So what's the alternative? What's the prescription? And that's what Carl Deutsch said. So when I went to his first lecture of his class, he said, the title was "Dead People Are Peaceful." I went like, really? Dead people are peaceful. So then he goes on to make the case and point that peace is not pacifism. It's not being passive. It's being assertive. It's being active towards creating, a new answer, a new vision. And that the social scientist, of which I consider myself, has sort of a moral responsibility to be both diagnostic, what's going on, and then prescriptive. It's like you go to the doctor's not going to say, "Hey, Jake, your blood pressure is like 250 over 175, and that's not really good. And hey, eat more salt." He's going to give you some advice on like, "Hey, baby, I'll watch your diet, you exercise, what's the prescription to get you to a better place," right? So a lot of people, in the academic world, don't do that. They talk a lot about what's going on, but they don't come up with, okay. So, in that time at Harvard, I bumped into this guy, John Rawls, who's like the guy, the justice guy. You want to study justice, you read his 800-page book, which I didn't do. But John Rawls says pretty much that, justice is something that touches everybody equally, whatever you're talking about. So from that, I got all these great takeaways. It was a terrific time. And then I decided not to come back to France. I wanted to go, I went out to California for a while and taught there. And I continued teaching a peace course, even though at Friends that in that first stint, it was more of a maybe a unit here or a small piece of something else. So when I went to California to teach for a period of time, I taught a standalone peace course and in the Bay Area. And then I got in contact with all the people at Berkeley and all the peace people out there, and that continued to grow. Aldous Huxley, all these really amazing people. I sort of, I became, I learned really quickly from the Harvard experience that you knock on a door, and the door's open, and then you engage in conversation, and someone say, hey, you ought to go to the Fletcher School to talk to Dean Goulon over there because he'd be really interested in this. And I'd go knock on that door, and they said, oh, you ought to talk to Roger Fisher, the Getting to Yes guy. And I'd knock on that door, and so it was just all these, and then Gene Sharp, who is right now, with the late Gene Sharp, considered to be the godfather of nonviolent direct action. In fact, I used to bring him down to Friends School. So I just learned to be assertive, knock on doors, learn, share, all that kind of stuff.
After your time in California, you make your way back to Wilmington Friends School in 79-80. So can you also just walk our listeners through the decision to come back and really how the Peace Corps that we have come to know and really love and appreciate now, how did that come to be in 1979-1980?
Bill Bickley is the head of the upper school at that point, my good friend and first year, roommate for a while. He calls me up and says, hey, Rick, you want to come back to Friends? And it's like 1979 or 80 around there. And I go, no way. Why would I want to come back to Wilmington? I'm living in San Francisco, and then he goes, well, I would like you to come back and really build out. The board of trustees of Friends School really wants to make Friends School more visibly Quaker and wants to have in its programming more clear expressions of Quakerism in action. And we would like you to come back. I would like you, and the school would like you to come back and bring the Peace Corps, put a Peace Corps in, and then also do service learning, put a service learning piece in. And I said, well, and I negotiated. I said, I'm not going to come back on an empty promise. I want to come back on this is a requirement for graduation. If I'm going to leave San Francisco, not that, and I didn't tell him that I was okay about coming back. I had to negotiate this a little bit. So I come back and they make, the Peace Corps is now a requirement graduation. All right. And it started out being a part of a full year social science experience. And then because and I also taught economics. So, and that course was a very popular and I think a really important course too. I then sort of decided at a point in time that the peace part needed to get bigger. And so then it became a full year requirement for graduation. And then we did put a service program in. Okay. And then later on, I helped put the International Baccalaureate in. I pretty much helped, I was the midwife on that. So, one of your later questions was, what are things that, that you're proud of? And I say, well, those three things are all, still alive and kicking. And those are things that I help facilitate, sort of, more of a, I like to see my role as a facilitator, a guide on the side kind of a character. So that was sort of me coming back. And then from 1980, till I retired, there was a quote, peace, justice, and social change course.
Why do you think the Peace, Justice, and Social Change course was so effective, and how did it evolve over the years?
And the course worked, I think, for lots of reasons, but it worked because obviously I had a passion on it, and that's important. But secondly, is that I learned pretty quickly. So I'm at Harvard and I'm running sections. And I mean, I can read and sort of, I can read the text, but a lot of the academic world is a lot of mystery on the language. I mean, there's a lot of this very complicated way of saying and doing things. And I realized that when I first got out of graduate school, my first week or so in a new setting, it was like I lectured. I mean, a little bit more than I would like to. And, of course, high school kids fall asleep in about 10 minutes of that. So I guess the bottom line, what I'm trying to say is that you have to, whenever you're teaching, you have to know your audience, And it's like I gave everybody a minute of attentiveness based on their chronological age. So 1-year-olds, you maybe get them for a minute to up to keep going up. So with high school students, I actually what strengthened my teaching down the road was I started doing this Alternatives to Violence project, which is all experiential learning, which means that the teacher is the guide. You provide the resources, you structure it. But you really want to make the student, and this is any student or a super smart student, maybe a kid that sort of struggles a little bit in some areas, they all have the opportunity to deal with material enough time, no more than 20 minutes on a reading assignment, basically, and that they you force them or ask them to think about, to reflect on it, write about it, paragraph, whatever, and then come into the room and share that with other people. And now they try their ideas, they listen to other ideas. And then it's my job to fill in the gaps when we debrief it. And that's what you do. That's what you do in an experientially based. So I was always interested in the developmental side of learning. And I studied that and experienced that in my graduate work too, was to, so how do people learn, And then so I use that in the in my teaching model. So if you walked into my classroom, during the, I guess most of my career, you would see the kids really engage and doing the heavy lifting and doing projects and the material obviously lent itself to it. So when you teach a course on social justice issues, you can plug into Wilmington. We used to do a whole unit on poverty in Delaware and take kids down into the city and then interact or with homeless people and like why is there poverty and who's poor and what can we do about it? So I always wanted to bring and put in front of students those people doing that kind of work. Okay. So there always would be experts or people in the immediate our region. One of the cool things we did, there was a peace and ecology club at Friends, and we organized a whole day. So now we have some legitimacy, some, it's clearly that, we're bringing some stuff to the school. So we created an afternoon where we had close to 50 different speakers from the Wilmington area come in. And these are people that had the NAACP, the American Civil Liberties Union, people trying to stop the nuclear power plant over in Salem. All these activists that were, doing different work. And so when they came in on these panels, and kids moved around the afternoon to different panels of different people. And I told all the panelists that you're only going to have like a half an hour for the four of you to interact. And each one of you only has 2 minutes to say who you are and what you're for, like nuclear free, I don't care, or whatever it is. And then the rest of it's going to be how you found that path. How did you find your way as an individual to spend all this time and energy working for whatever it is you're working? And the stories that came out, the personal stories were just amazing. How people had experiences in their life with, they discovered they were living in a neighborhood with a toxic waste site or something, and then they got energized and people were getting sick, and that motivated or energized them to be active in making their community better or whatever. And I remember walking down the hallway, and there was this, I walked by a classroom, and the panel in there has a one of these an older Quaker gentleman. The guy's in his 80s. He's probably in his late 80s, and I hear him saying to this group of high school kids, like, if I don't get arrested every 4 or 5 years, I'm not doing something right. And so I stop and listen, and then he goes on to explain why. And to his credit, the kids obviously listened to it, and I went like, wow, that's pretty awesome that there's somebody, of that age, this Quaker hero, that is still out there doing the work. So anyway, I'm wandering off a little bit, but so I think if you had to look at the kinds of focus that I was trying to put on my teaching was that, when you talk about social change, so one of the things I would do to start the classes was something that comes out of Buckminster Fuller's tradition. Actually, a Quaker, Kenneth Boulding, put this idea of, the earth is a sphere, the earth is a living, we're on a spaceship, that whole spaceship thing, right? So I would start this class with saying, okay, you're on a spaceship, you're in the captain's area, you got this big console in front of you, and all of a sudden this red light is just going off, So what questions are in your what jumps into your head? And of course you just everybody writes down, are we out of gas? Are we gonna crash? When's lunch? I don't know, all these questions. All these questions show up, and then you sort of, but you, I probably either said or would say, well, the spaceship is alive, and now then kids start asking other questions and say, okay, well, so how are we going to find the answers to all these questions? What are you going to study? And say, well, okay, well, you need to study, better study some physics, you better study some biology, you better start. So you find, in fact, if you look over my shoulder, that banner of the Earthrise, that was in my classroom, that was in that my teaching room at Friends. So we're all on the ship together, right? And there's a great quote that I used to use from Adlai Stevenson about being on a spaceship, and it's destiny is really a function of how we take care of it. I mean, that's the short version of it all. The safety of it. It's a very fragile, we're learning very quickly that it is a fragile spacecraft and you got to pay attention to it, be amazed by it, pay attention, be amazed, tell others. That's a Mary Oliver, the poet's quote. So that's part of it. And I think one of the cool things that, so if you're going to do this kind of work, as I alluded to earlier, you've got to, give people opportunities to create vision. So one of the things I used to do is make students write newspaper articles about themselves as a social activist in some future moment. Pick your topic, okay, and then write a write a Wilmington News Journal article about yourself doing something, and they were amazing. And you had to keep it to one page, because reader attention issues. And so these kids would now start imagining themselves, working on whatever it was they created. It could be a climate thing. It could be a, whatever, civil rights thing. And so you build in capacity for possibility. Okay. And that's what those kids at the end of it. So when they, I think with great pride, and it's just not myself, it's just Friends School. It was the Richard Bernards and the Bill Bickleys and all these other people, the Terry Maguire, all these other people doing this similar work, maybe in different disciplines, creating a product that said, we need to be active in the world and you can do it. So there's Friends School graduates all over the place, working in politics. I get so excited when I hear a Dan Pfeiffer, say, hey, I took this Peace course and, it woke me up, or, whatever. It showed me that there was other ways of doing things. I became a big fan of one of the things I plugged our kids into, and this is pre-Zoom, was I got involved with, I used to take the kids to the United Nations, all right? And I created a model for a couple of years where the course had like a global village, trying to get people in touch with the fact that we're all, how the world works and it's all interconnected and interdependent. And then you move into nonviolence as a way of changing something. It's just a you don't have to use nonviolence. You can bring an army in, but that's not very sustainable. And then so going into discrete units on what's a healthy economy, what's a healthy environment, what's a healthy what does sustainability look like? What are women? What's a healthy situation for women? So,
Can you describe the introductory unit called the Global Village and why that was particularly helpful as students settled in and began to take this course?
for a number of years, using that model, kids had a country. So I would, in each classroom, I would have like a Norway, so you could pick Norway, Jake, and then I might end up with Haiti, you know? So you have countries that are doing well, countries that are really struggling, and a bunch in between. So I designed it so there's that full spectrum, you know, of choice. And then you would go off. We would do that after we came out of the, you know, globe, the global village and the nonviolence unit. Let's say we do the economics unit. What does a healthy economy look like? And you, the traditional GMP, you know, inflation, all stuff. So we all, you learn the criteria to make a judgment about it's healthy or not healthy, right? And then you go back and check out Norway. Well, how does Norway fit those criteria? How does Haiti fit that criteria? And then you train the kids in social science strategies. Where are you going to get the information? So now they have to learn where to go to find all the information, you know, to make their point, whatever their point's going to be. And then at the end of the year, the so they would do that for each unit, okay? And then I would take them to the United Nations, and I would say to my friend who organized this trip, I want a panel of you know, the economic development person, somebody. I want a panel on the woman, somebody from the women's area. I want a panel, you know, from the, so we had all these panelists representing all these big topics we did. And then it's all going to be Q&A. And I said, tell your speakers, they got 2 minutes to tell us who they are and what they're, and then they're going to be questioned. So it was a blast. So we're sitting in like a conference room with speakers, you know, we've got the little microphones, hitting the button, and kids goes, friend's kid goes, hey, I'm Poland, and my country's got a corruption problem. What can I do? Where are the best practices? And the people on the panel would say, oh, we go, okay, well, the, you know, that is a, you know, it is a problem in some country, and here's where you go, here's what you do. At the, and at the end of it, I will tell you, we got invited back every year because they thought we were, they want to know what college we were from. You know, where are these kids from, right? So at the end of that year, when I was doing this model, the, here's your final exam. Your final exam is you've all studied these countries, and they all have some problem. There's not a country on the planet that doesn't have something going on. So pick a challenge, because that's the word I would use. Pick a challenge and then design a nonviolent direct action campaign to remediate it. That's your final exam. So now the kids are applying, you know, all those because the I'm not a my way of teaching nonviolent social change is not through philosophy. There's a lot of philosophy around it. You know, it's not through religion, although there's obviously a religion layer on it. It's all about practicality. You know, it's pretty much so the Gene Sharpian wing of which I'm in is really about the, you know, the social science research is pretty clear. You know, Erica Chenoweth, who they're studying right now at Friends School, is, you know, that it works. It's twice as effective as using violence, you know, in terms of getting something changed or moving forward. So anyway, that's sort of a little bit. And all that is to sort of get kids, you got to train them to be whatever your discipline is, social scientists. But, you know, kids could really get into it because it was contemporary, you know, it impacted their lives. You know, and I would, someone said to me, so, well, how do you stay on top of it? I said, well, listen, you know, I'm like the professor, but I got 50 graduate assistants because they're reading all these articles and telling me what's going on. And I have to read their little, you know, critiques and everything. So I got the best of both worlds.
You noted in a 2006 magazine article that the course may have started with a focus on awareness, and now its focus is very much on empowerment. The world needs more peacemakers. And this is a two-part question, which I know you're not supposed to do, but I guess, like, how did you empower students in this course? And then looking kind of to today's landscape, how has technology made it easier to feel empowered and empower students and people?
Well, it's a that's a huge question. So I'm just going to take a little bite at it. So I'm teaching right now, and so in fact, I just finished doing my third Friends School alumni course, and the one I and you know, the first one I did was in reaction to January the 6th. You know, like many people, I was like, oh my God, you know, here I am a civics teacher, and all of a sudden, what happened there? So I taught the course. I also teach at the University of Delaware Academy of Lifelong Learning. They call it OLLI. So I offered that course to Friends School, and about 20 folks signed up, more than that, but there was like 20 that stuck with it. And it was like a 10 session course, and it looked at, so what I did when I created that course was that I'd go to my poker group, and I'd go like, okay, anybody got a Proud Boy in your family? Anybody got like a, you got any QAnon people? Like, anybody got a FBI agent? I need an FBI agent. I need a Homeland Security. I need, you know, and one thing led to another. So I designed this Zoom course where, same deal, like, you know, you're Jake and you come in and you're in charge of Homeland Security for the state of Delaware. You're a Fed and you're going to tell us what Delaware's doing. Or I found a white supremacist guy, and he came in from Seattle, and this is a guy who had been a skinhead and then sort of moved out of it, and he talked about what it was that, you know, got him into it and then what got him out of it. So I put all these resources, I've got a blog and everything's on the blog, everything I'm telling you, all the readings and the TED Talks and all the stuff is there. So the classes I'm teaching now are all there. So the students would then once again go, if they wanted to, they're not getting a quiz, they would watch the TED talk about, you know, Daryl Davis, this black jazz musician who's like in a parade and carrying the flag as a Boy Scout, and people in Boston are throwing stuff at him. They can't figure it out. And then he has that unfortunate conversation that black families have that, listen, son, this is why people who don't know you hate you. You know, can you imagine that, having that with your kid? So he talks about that, but then he goes on to grow up, and he's a musician, and he engages all these Ku Klux Klan people, and they have some number, I can't remember the actual number, have stepped away from it because of that interaction with him and given him their Klan robes, right? So now he's telling his story about how he has dealt with that. So I'm bringing into this Zoom world, which is awesome. I can say, hey, Jake, listen, would you come in for an hour, you know, and just talk with us in conversation, like a Bill Moyers, about your experiences as a, you know, a white supremacist? And they go, sure. And now, and all the participants in the class would ask questions, and it was just astounding. Now, what came out of that was I would go around to all these, not only at Friends School, but when I taught at Delaware, I would say to all the participants, why are you taking this class? Why are you taking this class? And they go like, well, I've got a mother, excuse me, I have a husband, a sister, a brother, best friend. They've gone down some rabbit hole and they're polarized away from me and I can't talk to them anymore. We don't talk. Not only do we not talk, it's, you know, it's just begun negative. So they're looking for tools to sort of rebuild and reconnect. So I did the extremism course, and then I took that Alternatives to Violence project. So the Alternatives to Violence project came out of the American Civil Rights Movement. And it was people, Quakers for the most part, that did all these trans Friends Suburban Project, a children's program for creative responsive violence, all these kind of programs, then got that energy, got put on prison rehabilitation. What do we do for men or women in jails that have made bad decisions that might be looking for some tools to, you know, get better, get stronger? And that's where AVP, you know, found its next life. And that was the 1970s through the present. So anyway, I took, when you do that prison work that I'm still doing, part of that is like, well, how do you, when you find yourself in a moment of conflict or challenge, how do you understand, listen? How do you actively listen to what's coming at you? You know, and that means you have to learn how to listen, not talk back. You have to be able to, you know, if you're talking with me, whenever you're done saying, I got to do a little check. And Jake, did you, I hear you saying this, bang, bang, bang. Good. Now you've created some space where you know that I'm listening to you, right? And then there's a way for me to talk back to you that doesn't, you know, doesn't put a finger in your chest and flame it, or, you know, say bad things. So all those strategies from AVP have ended up in another course that I just finished teaching for friends called Tools for Courageous Conversations. And how do you engage in conversation with another person on a difficult topic? So, a little bit of personal story here. So right now my wife and I are getting ready to move. It's death, divorce, and moving are the three biggest stressors in one's life, so they say, right? So it's actually going quite well. There's not, there are these moments where, but having just taught this course twice, once to friend school, and then we did another one here for the local Jewish community because they're all upset because of all the anti-Semitic stuff that's been going on lately. So they wanted something similar. So this friend of mine who's a clinical social worker, I built this course out. And I'm using it every day, in terms of figuring out, okay, so 90, we know that 95% of everything we own is not going with us. So how do you make decisions about all this stuff, right? Anyway, so long story short, I'm still teaching, and in all those teaching strategies and technology. So I will never teach face to face again, probably not for the University of Delaware. I'll come up and do a friend school day, or I'm going to come up maybe and talk about in the current Peace Corps, spend a day with kids. But it's just I can get so many resources to come in. People give you an hour. It's a lot bigger than, flying somewhere, or it's a lot cheaper too, to be quite frank with you. So anyway, I'm a big fan. So, but the whole technology thing, I'm also a consultant for the International Baccalaureate. And I just literally finished a 3-day job with a school in Brooklyn called the Brooklyn Emerging Leaders Academy. It's an all girls, all girl charter school. It's a wonderful school. Okay. And that whole There's a whole chunk about that artificial intelligence and how they're doing that. And so, yeah, so it can be, I've always used it as an outreach thing. So when I would, once again, at Friends, I would take a number of students up to Philly and we would talk with kids from all over the world. I would write the curriculum, let's say, on globalization. And in that 5-week, 5-session class, there'd be kids from, let's see, Mexico City, Dominican Republic, Vancouver, Czech Republic, Philly, and then North Jersey. And they'd all be on, like sort of the Zoom, the predecessor to Zoom, which was WebEx or something. And they're talking, then I had to go, there's somebody from the UN on it for that, whatever the topic was. I'll never forget, there was this session, and the kids from North Jersey were ninth grade boys. It was ninth grade group, and they say to the Canadian kids, hey, this goes back now to, I can't remember which Iraqi invasion it was. Okay. And they go, hey, what do you all think about, Saddam Hussein and, getting rid of that bum, And these Canadian kids go like, you can see them on the screen. They sort of huddle up, And then they come back on the screen. They go, well, we think it's about the oil. We don't think it's about human rights, and we don't think it's about weapons of mass destruction. We think it's about really about oil. And the kids from North Jersey, start going like, well, what do you know? It sounded like a Saturday Night Live skit or something. What do you know? The Canadian kids circle up, and then they come back on, and they say, listen, one kid says, I was born in Chechnya. And my family had to leave there because of the troubles there, all the violence, and we left and moved to Vancouver. Next kid says, I was born in Serbia, and we had to leave Serbia during the Bosnian Wars because it was so bad. Another kid was from Cambodia. I forget where the fourth kid was from, but they all said, listen, our families were uprooted and we moved, we were refugees, and we came to Vancouver, and you guys need to know that it's a big world and people don't look at everything, the way you do. And I'm going, yeah. So the UN guy sort of raised his hand, a friend of mine, he wanted to say something. I said, come on. No, let these kids talk to each other. You know what I mean? So at the end of it, at the end of this fourth session, when we did the evaluation, those ninth grade boys out of North Jersey, actually Little Falls, New Jersey, gave the whole program the highest rating, even though it was clear that they were really very much more conservative. They were less, they didn't know much about the world, and now they're talking with all these kids from all over the place. So I think the one of the things that a teacher should do is to create opportunities for you to test out your ideas, run into different ideas. In fact, I used to get accused of being a communist in my early days, someone, and I had in my wallet, and so friend school, all schools reflect their communities. Okay. So the friend school of the 70s and 80s was a little more conservative in terms of what I was doing than it is now, right? So I had somewhere along the way gotten a come on, or actually a credit card from the Republican National Committee. It had an elephant on. It was a fundraiser, but I kept it. I never sent him money, but I kept it. I had it in my wallet. So when that moment showed up, when I was being accused of being a communist, I would go in my wallet. So listen, I am a card-carrying Republican, buddy. Just take that home.
That's awesome.
Because I would actually, someone over the years, I got sort of asked that question when I did a thing at Friends a little bit about pushback. And I welcome pushback. I mean, I one of the big signs in my room, on my bulletin board, was like, question authority. Don't believe everything I say. You need to go out. The whole point of all of this is you finding your path. I got a path. You got to find your own path. And I've had things on mine that have made me think the way I do. So anyway, that's just sort of an aside.
No, those are all really, really great asides, and I think speaks to the power of technology and all that we're able to do and bringing various voices into these conversations. So I thought that was wonderful. I want to touch on your AVP work, but before I do that, you did spend a lot of time at Friends, and I didn't really put this on the prep sheet, but I guess I'm just really curious as to kind of why you continue to stay at Friends for like as long as you did. What about the, I mean, obviously you were an instrumental figure in starting the Peace Corps, instrumental in the IB program, dedicating so much of your time to teaching so many Friends school students. Why?
Well, for me, teaching was an art, and so yeah, I had success, but what did Einstein say? Genius is 99% perspiration, so we all worked hard. But you were able to practice the art of teaching. So you had four classes, you had maybe 15 kids, 18 in a class. You could differentiate instruction. You really could, in some days, the way the schedule went, you might have three classes. And then, of course, you were expected to coach and you were expected to interact and all those other things, which is fine because for years, I coached three sports, my first stint. But having said all that, so it was an environment where you got motivated kids for the most part, you got motivated families, and you have the opportunity. There wasn't, so when the IB showed up, I mean, I'm in the back of the room going like, I don't want to teach to a test, Well, that's because I didn't know that what the IB was all about. Then I go off to a training, go like, wow, this is exactly what best practices we all should be doing, if you embrace the inquiry-based model, right? Rather than being a lecturer, the sage on the stage. So the thing that allowed, let's go back to the Cypress thing. So I, in late October of that year, I approached the head of school, Bill, and I said, Bill, I just got a call from, this Charlie Walker. He would like me to go to Cyprus for 3 months, November, December, January. I'll be back. And what do you think? And he said, I sort of thought about it, Bill Goulding. And he went like, do it, go for it. All right. So off I go. Now, right, I had to get a sub, and I knew the sub. They knew the sub was the wife of a faculty member who had been a teacher, so it all fit. I mean, I wouldn't have just walked out the door. So What kept me in the game was that friends had a sabbatical program. I got a couple of those. About every 5 or 6 years, I would just step away. And then I went to Bosnia in 98, spent a couple months on the ground there, interacting with friends, school families, or actually Bosnian refugees who come out. Friends had five of these kids in our school at that time. So I went back and spent time there getting it. As a political scientist or social scientist, I wanted to be a storyteller. I wanted to say, okay, here's the story to make the point, you know? So I always reinvented myself every 4 or 5 years, you know, just did something different. And I think Friends still has that program where they allow sabbaticals, people to are encouraged. It's really challenging sometimes to get people out of the building, to, you know, get out of the box, go learn new things. But anyway, that's what kept me going. Plus, it was just the fact that, and that's why not only myself, look at all the people that have been there a long time, you know, long, long time, because people go like, wow, you can really be a teacher here, you know. And you're really in a learning community, a lifelong learning community. John Hansen, who was a colleague of mine, helped turn my teaching career around because he went off and he came back and he trained the department on, you know, understanding by design, which was a new way of thinking and approaching teaching. And from that moment on, I embraced it and it made a world of difference. So I really enjoyed being in that sort of, you know, the Quakers sometimes are referred to as the seekers, you know, seeking the truth and all that. So there's a lot of people there, it was like fellow travelers, you know, that were, I just inspired me.
You mentioned the Alternatives to Violence Project in an earlier answer, and you mentioned a little bit about the work that you have been doing with them for quite some time. And you've also stated that the most gratifying work that you have done in your career is through the work in prisons. So could you just expand upon that a little bit and just tell our audience why that has been the most gratifying work?
I've been abroad to my, I've been to the former Yugoslavia, Bosnia in 98. Prior to that, in the early 90s, I got this recognition as teacher scholar for the state of Delaware. And it was a year-long study of immigration issues. And I went down to El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua twice, Mexico, and to study, you know, like, why are all these people leaving? What is going on? Of course, they all had major problems, civil wars, all kinds of stuff going on in the 80s. And I did that with a, and that was a, just a real, an amazing, once again, life-changing experience of being on the ground, traveling. So out of all that, and I come back and tell all these stories about what is it like to be, you know, have a death squad chasing you around, or, you know, whatever was going on as that I experienced. But then I realized that I didn't have an answer, so what am I going to do about it? You know, what do I, yeah, I can tell a story. So I came back from Bosnia, and that was a profoundly deep experience where we were, there was a genocide. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. It was a genocide that happened there in the 90s to the Muslim community, you know, imposed on them. And I had a little bit PTSD, and I knew that I just couldn't stay in that place. I needed, so I knew about AVP. So I said, well, I need to do something that gives it back. You know, I need to be a little more proactive, even beyond my teaching. So my wife and I got trained and then spent the next 10 years working at Chester Prison. It's a Pennsylvania facility just up the road. Ironically, it's right next to the casino, you know. But having said that, and then when I'm like, oh my God, I'm going into jail. What's that like? That's, I heard that's, jails are bad places. And what I discovered and have discovered since doing this, all this 25 years or 6 years, is that there's a lot of amazing people that are in jail who have made bad decisions, who are looking for help and tools and skills and want to get out of there, right? So right now, this just happened. I just missed the phone call last night from this gentleman up from Chester. So our program, the way it's designed, is that there's outside trainers like myself, but there's inside trainers also that have the same training. So when we go in as a team or whatever that weekend is that if you're a trainer, whether you're an inside or out, you're running an exercise, I'm doing the exercise myself. whatever that exercise is. It could be on anger, could be on forgiveness, it could be on active listening. And all the exercises are designed to have people pull from their own experience and talk about it and then find, either a path forward or whatever. So, my wife and I flat out will say, well, why do you go there? So, well, where else in your life? And so I loved your last question. What are you proud of? Where else in your life would you be able to say to somebody, speak to something that you like about yourself? Speak to something that you're proud of. Who in your life has been important? Well, pretty much there's nowhere to have those conversations. There are not many places, right? That's what happens every weekend in an AVP workshop, where people think about their lives. They're given tools and skills, right? So last night I missed this phone call. So one of our inside trainers from Chester, I go, this is a terrific friend school story, right? This guy has been in jail since 1970, somewhere in the 74, I'm a guess, right? So was that 50 years almost, 48 years? So he's been, quote, down or in jail. And so when we met him in Chester, he said, well, he was innocent and a victim of he didn't kill anybody, but he was there when somebody got killed and all this kind of stuff, right? And that in Pennsylvania state law, you're an accessory, your first degree, life imprisonment. So he's been in jail for 40, 50 years, whatever. Well, I go up to friend's school, homecoming, two homecomings ago, and I bump into one of my former students, Jeremy Gelb, who graduated in the early 70s, goes to Harvard, becomes a lawyer, now practicing criminal law, private practice in Philly. And I say to Jeremy, who I know very well. He was at Harvard when I was at Harvard and all that. I say, hey, Jeremy, do you ever do any pro bono work? With, he goes, yeah, on occasion. I said, well, listen, I gotta, if you'd be willing, I would like you to just take a look at something and tell me what you think. And he did. And he got involved in this guy's case. So he got involved. There was a federal public defender already involved in this guy's case. Jeremy's involved now. The Innocence Project has picked up this guy's case, and he might be getting out. There's a chance that after 50 years of incarceration, articulate, I mean, because you always put an adjective handle on who you are when you work in these programs, could be coming out of jail. And so, I mean, I'm going, that's, and that's what happened to Reuben Hurricane Carter. He got put in jail for doing something he didn't do, and then spent time, did time, and then got out. So I'm not saying every guy that I work with in jail deserves to get out or not do their full service. The people have done some really, you're never allowed to say to somebody, hey, Jake, why are you in here? Or how long, that's just, you don't do that. But in the course of conversation, you'll learn that people have made some really bad decisions. And that's why they're in jail, but for the most part, the people that I work with want to find another a way out or path forward, or they don't want to stay in jail. They've got kids and sort of sad to, to hear them talk about not being at their mom's funeral because they're in jail and all that kind of stuff. So, I think a real mark of society is how do we treat those that are marginalized? How do we treat the most vulnerable people in our society? And I think our society could do a better job for sure. And I will tell you that when my wife and I and others go into to in this case, I'm down here in Georgetown, Delaware. When we go in and spend the weekend, they appreciate it. They really, really appreciate the fact that these people are here working to help us, and they don't have to be here. And it's not like I'm telling them what they got to do. This is not a 12-step program. I'm just creating an opportunity for them to learn some skills. And it's a lot of role playing, all kind of stuff. So anyway, I leave feeling empowered at the end of it. I'm tired because, you're on for it's a Friday night. It's 18 hours usually of a Friday and Saturday and Sunday. So there's that kind of like, as a facilitator, you got to be paying attention, But anyway, that's and that program not only, oh, here's another story. So we take AVP, or we're actually being trained in it, and it's 1998 or 2000, and we're now in Croatia. And we go to, we and we're the our we are, I would say, my wife and I are apprentices, meaning we haven't really, you have to do, we've only done a couple workshops, right? We've been trained, and we're with this one of the founders of it, Steve Angel. And so we're now in Croatia, and we're in a circle. It's all done in a circle. And in that circle, it's a community workshop. So it's just not done in jails. It can be done in communities. And in that circle are some Hungarians, I think else, some Serbs for sure, and some Muslims and some Croats. So, that an ethnic blend there. And it comes out during the course of the workshop that a woman, one of the women participates, discovers that the Serb gentleman is living in her apartment. She got pushed out of her apartment, and this guy's living in it. And not only is he living in her apartment, he was the military commander that killed her husband. So I'm sitting there going like, wow, how's this going to play out? Now you've discovered that someone's living where, and you're, I don't know where she was living, but it clearly wasn't her own home. And now this, and the guy also, helped kill her husband. And both my wife and I tell the story over and over again of just watching this dynamic of the two of them, where he asked for forgiveness and she was able to forgive him. That is so intense. So, I mean, not that. So, for either one of those things to happen, you have to be open and ready. That's a forgiveness. So, forgiveness is one of the topics in these trainings. How do you let it go? It's not like you forget, you don't forgive the behavior, you forgive the person, right? So for me, that has been, it's sort of talk about continuing education, lifelong learning. It's something that, how do we, and especially in this day and age, how and where can we sort of have access to an opportunity? It's not therapy, don't get me wrong. It is not therapy. It's not intended to be. But how can you have a forum or a space where you can sort of engage in those kinds of conversations? Not too many places. So anyway, I'm a big believer and a fan of it, and I've seen it work in jails. I've seen it work internationally. I've seen it work, that's restorative justice, reconciliation. It's all over the place. It has a power. So the core of it is transforming power, the fact that you can have a situation of negativity and it can go a different direction. So the key is, how do you de-escalate it? How do you then move it to, a win-win outcome? And I used to do this stuff in friend school, but every friend school course has a lab period, all right? And it's a 70-minute period. It's a longer period than you get to do your science lab. And that was the intention, but that meant that everybody else had a 70 minutes. So for a number of years, I would build in these exercises for the students, on how do you listen? How do you build a culture? How do you build a culture of peace in your classroom? And I think kids, we learn by modeling for sure, but we all need tune-ups, that's for sure.
My last question for you, and normally I ask folks what they're most proud of, but you have answered that question a variety of times throughout our conversation. So I guess I'd like to know what, when you left Wilmington Friends School, what legacy did you hope to leave, knowing that the Peace Course is still here, still very relevant, and touches each student in high school, but also in doing a variety of these podcasts with various alumni, they have mentioned you as somebody who is instrumental in their education. So, yeah, I guess again, leaving friends and leaving being a full-time teacher every day, what legacy did you hope to leave behind?
Wow, that's, well, thank you for sharing that. I'm just sort of, let me bathe in that for a second. Well, you never, it's a great question. Maybe it goes back to my point about just finding what you love to do. Do it as best you can. I don't care. Be a fly fisherman. Be whatever it is you want to be. Be the best you can. and other people will gravitate either towards it or enjoy it or celebrate it. You know what I mean? So I love the life of the mind. I have a curiosity. I'm open-minded. And I really like the notion of continuing revelation. So, you know, which means that as you try to find an answer to something, whatever it is, you're open to maybe there's another answer. And I've seen that happen so much, so many times, and it's helped me feel okay about maybe I don't have the right answer. And Quaker process can be long, and oh my God, let's get this figured out, and oh my God. But at the end of it, there's usually an answer that works or is sustainable over time, right? So I think in terms of my legacy is I think maybe it's the hope that all of us, every kid in that room has the power to be a genius, to be extraordinary, to make a difference no matter where they are.